This broadcast is part of the Atlanta Business League's official 90th anniversary celebration.
This is Lessons from Leaders, an Atlanta Business League podcast.
I'm Lonnie Johnson, and I'm an inventor.
And he will spend the next 30 minutes sharing stories about his life and business breakthroughs. Lessons from Leaders is a part of the Atlanta Business League's Telling Our Story broadcast series.
You may know the name and remember one of his accomplishments. Lonnie Johnson invented the Super Soaker. That toy water gun allowed him to earn millions of dollars by becoming a businessman scientist. What you don't know is the Super Soaker is not his most impressive accomplishment or his latest invention. Lonnie is an ideas guy who also has the ability to create many of the fantastic notions that come into his head. Here's one way to understand how scientifically prolific he is.
I've registered about 140 patents.
And many of those patents are for energy products that sound like something straight out of a science fiction movie. Two of these inventions, a battery and an engine, may be on the verge of revolutionizing energy use as we know it. Lonnie can explain why succinctly, while he also explains the function for each of the companies he's founded to handle his wide-ranging ideas.
I have four companies. Johnson Research is the home company where we did the toys and other things out of that company. Now I've spun off two energy companies. JTech Energy is a company that's developing a new type of engine that converts heat directly into electricity. And what's fascinating about it is that it's an engine that looks like it'll be more efficient than engine that's existed in the past. And it has no moving mechanical components. It's all solid state. And the other company that I've spun out is a battery company. We've developed two battery technologies. We're working on lithium air, which is further out. But the near-term advanced battery technology that we're on the verge of launching is a solid-state battery. It uses glass as an electrolyte instead of a liquid, and it offers about twice the energy of lithium-ion batteries. So we're expecting a huge impact in the energy storage space from, you know, automobiles to grid storage and even personal computers and cell phones. Fourth company is actually a real estate company. It owns a property where we operate.
Some of you may be on the verge of understanding what many Black business people in Atlanta already know. Lonnie Johnson may be the premier scientist of our lifetimes. And it started because of his interest in something that has always fascinated him.
I've had a long-term interest in energy. In fact, I was working on a new type of heat pump when I came up with the Super Soaker.
But he abandoned chasing what seemed to be far-fetched energy ideas as a younger man to tug on what looked like the low-hanging fruit of creating a really powerful toy water gun. Well, nothing is ever as it seems, so it took 10 years to move the Super Soaker from concept to the cash register. And along the way, Lonnie learned some very hard lessons about business, which he now applies to inventions he plans to bring to market in the 21st century.
It's one thing to actually develop the technology and have a solution in hand. It's another thing to turn that into a business. I understood the magnitude of the risk of trying to develop something new that didn't exist when you don't have the materials, you don't know what the solutions are. You're really charging off into the unknown with the goal in mind, but you don't know exactly how you're going to get there and what problems you're going to run into. So I wanted to bring the risk down to the point before I started talking to friends and family about investing, because I didn't want to get a lot of people mad at me and even lose their money and feel guilty and terrible about the failure. Now, I said all that to say that if you bring in money too early, it costs you a lot because you have, the risk is higher. You have to give up a bigger percentage of the company. And then if it fails, then you no longer own the company because the investors own it and you got all these headaches. So now we've been able to, with the risk much lower, we've gone through A rounds in both companies, the seed round we've gone through in both companies, where you raise money from high net worth people, friends and family rounds, it's often called. So you raise some money to really get a firmer foundation. So we did that first for the energy converter company, the engine company, JTEC Energy. We raised about a little over $2 million for that company to do a demonstration. And then at that point, an investor came in, a major investor, and put in another $30 million. And so that company is off and running. We're doing a demonstration project to convert waste heat, low temperature, low grade waste heat into electricity. Most energy systems, when you lift the hood of your car, all this heat, you need a radiator, you got hot exhaust coming out. There's only about 15% of the energy available in the fuel actually moves your car forward. The rest of it is just waste heat. And so being able to convert more of that waste heat into actual power will make a huge difference in energy efficiency and the environment. So that's what that company is about. So we've raised that, and the project we're doing right now is to put together a demonstration unit for about a 250-kilowatt waste heat to electric converter where we produce electricity directly from waste heat. The other company, the energy storage company I talked about, we've done a seed round on that one, and in the next couple of months or so, we're going to do the A round where we'll go out for about $50 million to raise for the battery company. Fortunately, I've been able to bring on some business partners who are two serial entrepreneurs here in Atlanta who have access to capital and also have, because of their successful business track record, are able to get investors and bring investors to the table and give me the exposure that I needed in order to raise the capital to launch the company.
Yes, you just heard about an engine that turns waste heat into power. And you should know that one of the two batteries is something that he's worked on for more than 20 years. It has no moving parts. Incredible innovations. But in reality, a lot of those started when he wanted to build a heat pump that didn't use Freon.
And so I wanted to have this heat pump that would use water as a working fluid instead of Freon. And so I made some machines, some nozzles, and I had them hooked up to the bathroom sink with the idea of using what's called a Bernoulli effect, a jet pump that would pull water vapor and evaporate water to create a cooling effect. And I hooked these nozzles up to the bathroom faucet, and I shot the stream of water across the bathroom, and I thought to myself, you know, I really enjoy this stream of water. A high-performance water gun would really be cool, and I'm having problems getting people to understand and invest in my really hard science projects. So I decided to put those projects aside and develop a high-performance water gun. And so I applied some basic engineering principles to the design of that gun. And so it took a few weeks to build it. So you had to make all the components, put them together, assemble the gun, using machines to cut the plastic shape, different check valves and all of the fittings and things like that that would go into the gun. Actually, I got everything, all the parts made, and I started putting them together and assembled the gun and shot it for the first time. It was really, really satisfying.
And most of us have used that final product. It's more than satisfying. It's just plain fun, which is why Lonnie thought it would be a breeze to manufacture his newly invented toy that squirted a whole lot of water and sell it. Didn't quite work like that.
It only took a few weeks to build the first gun and get it working, but it took 7 years to get it to the market. At first, I wanted to manufacture the gun myself and set up my own company and everything. And I went to talk to an injection molding company that could make all the plastic components. And he told me it would cost about $200,000 to get the first 1,000 guns off the assembly line. At the time, I didn't understand business, a lot of aspects of, you know, amortization of tooling and all of the things, and, you know, scaling production to bring in cost of individual components down. This just wasn't there because I was, you know, in the military dealing with space systems and had spent time at NASA designing outer planetary spacecraft and these kind of things. So engineering was my thing. Business was not. So I said, okay, $200,000 to get the first 1,000 guns. That means that each gun would cost $200. Well, who's going to pay $200 for a gun? That was my simple math. It only took a few weeks to build the first gun and get it working, but it took 7 years to get it to the market. At first, I wanted to manufacture the gun myself and set up my own company and everything. And I went and talked to an injection molding company that could make all the plastic components. And he told me it would cost about $200,000 to get the first 1,000 guns off the assembly line. At the time, I didn't understand business, a lot of aspects of amortization of tooling and all of the things, and scaling production to bring in cost of individual components down. Engineering was my thing. Business was not. So I said, okay, $200,000 to get the first 1,000 guns. That means that each gun would cost $200. Well, who's going to pay $200 for a gun? That was my simple math.
So Lonnie realized he had to find a manufacturer, but that meant he would have to trust people he didn't know with his idea and the plans to build it.
Two things. One, if nobody knows about it, I can't make any money. And there's certainly some things I don't understand about business and I need to learn. So I'm going to put this thing out there. If I lose, the least thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to learn some things that I don't know now, and I'll be able to apply the things that I learned to my next idea. And so that was my attitude about it. So I went forward, started talking to people about it, got non-disclosure agreements where I could, but there were a number of false starts. What was encouraging about it was that there were very few companies who did not like it. Everyone I showed to liked it. The companies have their own issues. You know, you talk about business.
The only company interested in his water gun was sold and then purchased and resold again.
They ended up taking the prototype to Hong Kong to try to get into production. Apparently the engineers there had problems. They took the gun apart and then they couldn't reproduce its performance. They asked me for another prototype. And so it was one false start after another. And so by, you know, 7 years later, 1979, I went to New York to Toy Fair, was literally walking the halls looking for someone to talk to about my idea. I met a guy there who said, go over and talk to Laramie, because at Toy Fair, the different companies are there and they're showing their goods to buyers, retailers, and they didn't let their competitors into the showroom because it is a treacherous knockoff industry. People steal ideas left and right, so they're very careful about who they show their product to for the coming year. So I went and talked to these guys. I met the vice president, and I told him what I had. And I didn't have a water gun with me at the time, and I had no intention of showing it. And he said, well, you know, I can't really review product here, but would love to look at what you have. And if you come to Philadelphia, where our headquarters is, and we could sit down and review it there. And I said, great. You know, so I got up and was walking out the door, and he yelled at me. He says, oh, by the way, don't make a special trip. So, of course, like, it just totally burst my bubble.
But the burst bubble held a ray of hope. And since it was better than sitting at home hoping somebody would call, Lonnie did take a trip to Philadelphia on his own dime. But he also brought his water gun prototype with him.
During that meeting, the president of the company looked at the stream of water and said, wow, he was totally impressed. And then they started talking about, okay, if we, you know, we could do this and we could sell it at this price. And when they started brainstorming in terms of how to transition from my prototype to the market and what price it may have to sell at, and they would start thinking about problems that they'd have to solve along the way. Best thing I could do is just back away, be quiet, and let them continue this brainstorming because they're going where I want them to go. And, you know, it was Warren Buffett who said, I think, that the best way to make money and be successful in business is to create opportunities for other people to make money.
Lonnie didn't realize it at the time, but he had just started another form of education. Of course, he expected to learn from the process of taking his invention into production.
And so by working with a company that knew how to take it from the prototype and into production, I felt I would learn that process. And so a licensing deal would be one where I get to participate, and all the guns that they sell, they give me a percentage of the sale price on each product. And so that would be a licensing arrangement. And it turned out very successful. When I met the people at Laramie in 1990, it was on the shelves in stores. That year it was called Drencher. We ended up with someone claiming that they owned that name and they wanted to be paid royalties. So Laramie changed the name to Super Soaker in 91. And in 92, it was the number one selling toy in the world.
However, there's a big difference between being taught and getting schooled. The name change was great for sales, not necessarily for Lonnie.
At the time, if I understood business better, I would have insisted on joint ownership in the name because they had actually called me about for ideas for a name. But in any case, Laramie owned the name Super Soaker. I owned the patents that covered how the Super Soakers worked. So when Super Soaker became successful, Laramie started putting other products in the line with the Super Soaker brand that did not use my technology or use my patents, but they were making profits on those, and they were literally leveraging the success from the patents and the product line that I started with the water gun.
What most people don't realize is the same man who made the Super Soaker water gun also invented several other best-selling toy guns. He signed a deal with a better-known toy manufacturer to sell those products and, again, graduated to a new level of learning about business.
So I was literally the king of all toy guns at one point. To me, that speaks to the power of creation, the power of imagination, rather, and the ability to turn imagination into reality. Now, when I did the license with Laramie for the water gun, I also had compressed air rockets and some other things that were in that deal. Laramie kind of sidestepped me on those, and it was interesting the way that evolved because it got to the point where I would bring in an improvement. Somehow, that wasn't my idea. I come back again, I get another improvement, it's even better. And so I realized I'm competing against myself. And so this is not working. So I said, okay, I'm not going to go back to Laramie anymore. I'm going to go to Hasbro. So I started designing these dart guns, and Hasbro was doing Nerf at the time, and they literally owned the market in the shelf space. But I designed a whole line of guns that performed better than what Nerf had at the time, and I went and presented that to Hasbro, and they really liked it, and they obviously did not want me to take those guns to a competitor. And so they did a licensing deal with me as well. And I think the idea was to, put some product out. But eventually when they started putting product out and they all performed better than what they were selling in the past, the InStrike product line grew and became very successful.
First, he realized that he had to challenge the Laramie Company in court.
And I was collecting royalties. They started to feel like, well, wait a minute, this is not fair. So they arbitrarily started reducing the royalty payments. So I filed a lawsuit against them. So when I did the deal with Hasbro on the dart guns, I said, look, I want to have my own category on the Nerf. You can name it whatever you like, but that brand name, that subcategory of Nerf, that's where my intellectual property, my patents will reside, and guns that use my patents will reside. But anything that you sell under that brand name where my patents are applied, you have to pay royalties on. So sure enough, the InStrike line became very, very successful, and Hasbro started putting other product under that line, leveraging that brand name. But then my royalties started to go down because they were using less of my patents, but still leveraging the brand name that my patents had launched and started and made successful. So I was literally in a toy store one day, and I said, well, okay, toys go through this success, or they peak, and then they go down, and they become less popular, and so that's just the way toys go, right? But when I went to the store and saw InStrike and saw all this product up there, I said, wait a minute. Someone called Hasbro, and he said, oh, no, you're misinterpreting the contract. And I said, no, I negotiated the contract that way. We went back and forth for months, and they just didn't yield, and so I ended up filing a lawsuit. So the lawsuit, where the $73 million was awarded in my favor, was really over dart guns and not the Super Soaker. Most people don't realize that. So I set a goal, had achieved that goal of being the king of all toy guns, and it was my way of proving that it wasn't by accident, it was just by determination, and lightning can strike in the same place twice.
If inventions are lightning, then Lonnie Johnson has been summoning electricity from the sky his entire life. He built a functioning robot in 1968. That's not the incredible part of the story. What's incredible is that he did it by himself in segregated Alabama, won a major science fair award, and still didn't get asked to apply to engineering universities in the state.
I was working on my robot. I literally built this robot in my mother's kitchen and took up about a third of the kitchen with parts and components and hardware and tools and things. You know, took up a big part of the space because we didn't have a lot of space in our home. We were six kids. There were three bedrooms in the house, a bathroom, a living room, and a kitchen. And that was it. And so taking up a big portion of the kitchen was a big deal. I'm just thinking about that. But, you know, I had that robot. It took me about a year because I had been working on small projects and other things, doing the rockets and things. And I would look for something else to work on. And so I thought, I want a big project, something that's going to be a challenge and can take some time that I could really focus on. And so this robot took about a year to build. And when I finished him, you know, I wanted to put him in science fairs because I kept missing him because, you know, the robot wasn't ready. Spring of 68, the final robot competition I could put my robot in was at the University of Alabama, where kids from all over the Southeast region U.S. were participating. And it was the Junior Engineering Technical Society. I was the president of my Junior Engineering Technical Society club, the JETS. So this was a big deal. I was all excited about this, and my robot was ready. My two science teachers took us up, took me and two other students up. They wrote some technical papers that they were going to present at the conference, and I was presenting my robot. We were the only black kids there. It was hosted by the School of Engineering at the University of Alabama. The Dean of Engineering hosted the conference. The entire time we were there, he never said anything to us, me or my teachers. The judges who decided on the rankings of the presentations were all from industry. And I guess that made a huge difference because obviously I was not expecting, well, certainly black people were not expected to walk away with any trophies. Lonnie's won first place, but they never asked me about my grades or showed any interest in me taking engineering classes at the University of Alabama. This was just a few years after Wallace had stood in the door and said that no black students would ever come to the university. I attended Tuskegee University, and I'm really, really happy about that. It was a great experience. I was very well prepared, as I learned throughout my professional career.
Plain, unadulterated racism meant the University of Alabama could never call on Lonnie Johnson for alumni donations. Think about that for a minute, why don't you? From Tuskegee, Lonnie joined the Air Force. He worked at Oak Ridge National Laboratory as a nuclear engineer while waiting to be called for active duty. Active duty sent him to Albuquerque, New Mexico at the Air Force Weapons Lab. He was part of the technical team.
The Air Force and the Department of Energy and NASA had this interagency nuclear safety review panel. Each agency had their technical teams that would do these safety analyses, and they'd all analyze independently and try and come up with the overall consensus on what the risk of launching that system would be.
But they got it wrong, and Lonnie wrote a paper telling them so.
If I remember that correctly, there was no way for the spacecraft to reenter the atmosphere. So I did an analysis that showed that that was wrong. So as a result, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who was responsible for the Voyager spacecraft, offered me a job. So I left the Air Force and went to work at JPL. And at JPL, I was assigned to the Galileo mission, which was the next mission after Voyager. Galileo went to Jupiter. I was responsible for integrating the power system onto that spacecraft as a nuclear engineer with a nuclear power source, again, using these radioisotope thermoelectric generators. And the way I like to describe that is that the spacecraft had components that were literally being built all over the world. And we at JPL controlled the designing of the overall spacecraft. So all these components were being built around the world, literally and across the U.S., of course. But one day, all those components were going to be delivered there to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where they would assemble the spacecraft. Well, everything had to fit together like a puzzle, right? So making sure that everybody understood the design and what their components, the shape, size, fit, weight of it, the interconnects, the electrical connections, the signals that all the plugs had. So all of those details had to be worked out and documented for this very, very complex space system. the ultimate robot. So I'm working on a robot that's going to other planets. I invented a memory keep alive power supply for the memories because one of the problems we ran into was that if there was a short circuit, for example, if there was an inside one of the instruments or on some system on the spacecraft, if something failed and you get a short circuit, like a circuit breaker in your house, right? If a circuit breaker flips, then the circuit, then the lights go out. So if that happens on the spacecraft and all the electrical power goes down, then if the power comes back up, the spacecraft automatically starts, relays start opening and all kinds of things start happening in order to get rid of the failure points and we can figure out what's going on and we can make a contact. But if it stayed down too long, the capacitors that would keep the computers alive would discharge and then all of a sudden there's no power, no memory in the spacecraft because everything gets wiped out. So I came up with a circuit that would protect against that. And so when I told the chief systems engineer what my idea was, I said, look, these guys are going to say this won't work. When they say that to you, let me know. I'll go home and build one in my garage and bring it in and demonstrate it. No, I didn't have to do that. They were about to let me embarrass them that way. So we built it. But what did happen was that some of them actually came up to me and apologized to me after the fact because of the things that they were saying about my idea. And one of them to the point where I said, well, geez, what did you say? And he said, oh, never mind. He wouldn't tell me what he was saying about my idea behind my back. But that's okay. We got it on the spacecraft. It was a huge personal moral victory again because I found myself working with literally hand-picked engineers from around the country. This was the most advanced space system that the country had at the time. And these were top engineers working on it. And I was doing things that they said was not possible.
There's a theme here, and it's called believing in yourself, specifically when no one else does. Lonnie Johnson credits his parents with helping him master that attribute.
Because my parents did not stymie my imagination, they actually encouraged it. And if they were not supportive, I would not have had the freedom, determination, or even interest in going to the library. So I think that my parents, by far, were the most important element in my success. I'm someone who perseveres. I have big goals, big ideas, and I will persevere toward achieving them. Sometimes my goals, I may have to modify them a little bit, but I don't give up too easy.
Lonnie Johnson, you can call him rocket scientist, you can call him nuclear engineer, mastermind, creative genius, a man who may change the future for all of us, but you can't call him a PhD. He does hold undergrad and grad degrees from Tuskegee, but...
I took courses, graduate courses toward my PhD at the University of New Mexico. I took a couple of classes. Also took a couple of classes at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. But I'd be sitting in those classes and just totally impatient. I said, you know, we're going through textbooks, analysis, and things like that. I'm like, these problems have all been solved already. They're in a textbook. I want to work on problems that have not been solved yet. I just ran out of patience. I just couldn't sit there anymore.
So while Lonnie doesn't really care that no one can officially call him Dr. Johnson, he does worry about the inventors who haven't had his determination or good fortune.
I wish I had more time and had the ability to really respond to all the inquiries I get from would-be inventors, particularly black inventors who are seeking help. You know, I help when I can.
As he is doing with a guy who has a camera patent.
And maybe it was a point where I was just feeling I need to do more than I'm doing, or whatever it was that motivated me to respond that way. So it turned out that this guy had a patent and he had another one pending on these cameras, the door cameras, and I decided to help him out, and we've been working together. We filed some lawsuits and actually gotten some, had some successes. You know, I found out along the way that he was blind, and I said, wait a minute, this guy blind? So I asked him, I said, well, how do you come up with a door camera, idea for a door camera when you're blind? And he says, well, the reason I'm blind is because someone came to my door, and I didn't see who it was. I opened the door and I got shot in the face. And so that's what motivated him to come up with the idea. And so I felt really, I felt fortunate that I actually taken the time with that individual, because you know it turned out to be an opportunity to really do have a positive impact with someone who really deserved some help.
And so we come full circle on the business life of Lonnie Johnson as of January 2023. He invented the Super Soaker because he had wanted to improve heat pumps. In his case, diverting his engineering energies to a different project created resources for his future ideas. It just doesn't work like that for most people.
It really does come down to a lack of access to resources. And even the companies that I'm launching now, the energy companies, those are not things, even though I'm solving big problems, they're good solutions. Without the resources, they'd stay in the laboratory.
Which is why Lonnie has used part of his research campus in downtown Atlanta as a laboratory for students who want to know more about robotics and other STEM-related studies.
But the other company that I didn't mention is JSAC. It's a Johnson STEM Activity Center where we bring in kids from literally all over the state for various events in STEM. We have a robotics program where we have teams there on site that actually build robots and compete. We have a partnership with Meta and the 880 Foundation, which is a foundation set up by Steve Young and Jerry Rice. And we have a computer center there, esports arena, and a virtual reality creative space where kids can come in and literally experience a wide range of things, from gaming all the way to things like parachute jumping. The other thing that we're really expanding into is actually being able to go into other laboratories and other locations where kids can actually go into engineering environments and research environments and experience and see things that they otherwise wouldn't be exposed to. So we're really excited about the impact that that program is going to have on our youth here in Atlanta and literally across the state.
Of course, many of those young people rightfully see Lonnie as their hero. Lonnie has a hero of his own, George Washington Carver, the peanut scientist from Missouri. Lonnie, have your accomplishments surpassed that of your hero?
Oh, wow, that's an unfair question. Short answer is no. As difficult as the challenges that I've had to deal with, his were much greater. Much, much greater. I was on my way down to Tuskegee and it stopped there at a mall. And there's this big mural on the wall showing George Washington Carver and Henry Ford walking together. And it turned out that Ford apparently had financed most of his research. I didn't know this. I learned this just a few years ago. So it really brings the point home about the need for resources, because if you're going to be successful in business, like I said earlier, you got to create opportunities for other people to make money. My wealth creation tool is the ideas and inventions that I come up with. That's the way I look at it. In fact, one of my strategies and thoughts about all of this is that, you know, the U.S. patent system is awesome, or the global patent system, actually, and you can enforce it in other countries. If you can create a better mousetrap and protect that mousetrap, and it's something that the world needs and will benefit from, well, that will benefit you, and you can control where the benefits go. You can control and have impact on who gets the jobs, where the products produce, because you have that kind of leverage.
There are a lot of people who don't like science. They're scared of it. But because of science, almost all of us have access to luxuries that allow us to be warm in the winter and cool in the summer, or relieve headaches by swallowing a pill. These are conveniences unavailable to kings and other powerful people for thousands of years. Yet, scientists like Lonnie Johnson are rare. First, because he's managed to keep a childlike curiosity, the same type of curiosity that inspired him to build a robot as a teenager. And Lonnie is rare, secondly, because he was willing to learn the value of business and then make both business and science work for his benefit. Lonnie Johnson may never take the time necessary away from his busy life of being a businessman inventor, to sit in the class to earn a PhD. So perhaps he should be honored with something more appropriate, like a PCD, a perpetual creator degree.
You've just listened to an Atlanta Business League episode of Lessons from Leaders. This is part of the Telling Our Story broadcast series produced by Marty Covington of The Right Ones, recorded at The Plug Studios in Atlanta, Georgia, and edited by Chase Allen of Marchaz Co-Productions, LLC. All rights for this broadcast are reserved.